On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For a decade now, the U.S. economy has been riding surging productivity and two giant bubbles. First, the tech bubble that went bust in 2000, then the housing bubble that ballooned when the Federal Reserve took interest rates down to an astonishing 1%. Now housing has stalled out in more than half the country, and many economists are asking if the whole party's over. Last week, the Fed laid off, for the moment, its long campaign of hiking interest rates to fight inflation. But no one's sure inflation is tamed. More hikes and big job cuts may be in the offing, maybe recession. There's even talk for the first time in many years of stagflation, the dread double whammy of recession and inflation. Up next on Point, hold on to your hat. We're looking at the U.S. economy now. Joining me first today from Washington is Edmund Andrews. He covers the economy for the New York Times. He wrote last week that there is a lot of skepticism about a soft landing ahead. Edmund Andrews, thanks very much for joining us.
I'm glad to be here, Tom.
So here we just heard at the top of the hour, I don't know if it was in your ear, but the news saying, hey, you know, inflation beyond oil, inflation not so bad in the new report today, economy slowing. Does Ben Bernanke have this thing on a soft landing glide path?
Well, he might. We don't know yet. There is no question that the economy is slowing down. And unfortunately, there's no question that inflation is still heating up. Today's inflation numbers were better than Wall Street people had been expecting. They were slightly better. But by any measure, the core numbers that the Fed watches, which is inflation taking out the volatile prices of energy and food, those numbers were up higher than their unofficial target range. If they want to do what they say, which is to get sort of the underlying rate of inflation down to about 2% a year, they're still high of that mark, and the chances are that the inflation trend is going to be up slightly rather than down slightly in the months ahead.
Edmund Andrews, you write about Ben Bernanke being in what some of the economists you've spoken with as a no-win situation. Describe for us the dynamics that he's wrestling with here. What's the no-win dynamic here?
Well, this gets us back to the dreaded Phillips curve, an idea that was discarded for a long time, which says that there's somehow a trade-off between growth and higher employment on the one hand and inflation on the other hand. The no-win situation is as follows. Inflation is running at a minimum of about almost 3% a year right now. Mm. If you exclude energy and food, if you include those things, it's running closer to 5% a year now. That's much higher than the Fed wants. So what do you have to do in theory? What you have to do to bring that level down, to reduce consumer demand, business demand enough so that price pressures are eased, the models basically say, and the historical experience says, that you need to reduce employment by a full percentage point for a year to reduce the inflation rate by a half a percentage point. The Fed's goal is to reduce inflation, at least theoretically, a full percentage point. So you have to notch up unemployment, even under this scenario, by about 2 percentage points. That's a couple of million people unemployed. And that's assuming that we don't have any other external shocks. A lot of economists think that there are some added problems that make the economy already weak. We still haven't felt the full economic impact of higher energy prices. We don't know exactly what the fallout from the housing market is going to be, but it could be quite significant. We just don't know. And then there are things like the dollar. If it declines in value abruptly, which is entirely possible, then import prices would go up and the Fed's job gets harder. Last but not least, if there is a slowdown in productivity growth, and there are indications that is happening. If that proves any more enduring, that really adds to the complexity of the whole problem. So if they really want to get their inflation numbers down, most economists are saying you can't square that with keeping unemployment as low as it is right now and growth almost as high as it is right now.
So Ben Bernanke, in the situation, in the position of having to hope for 2 million jobs lost in order to try and keep a lid on inflation by slowing the economy down in that way. And then the further frontier you describe that has people really worried is that he may end up with both a weaker economy and inflation. That goes all the way back to the 1970s, stagflation. Define that for us.
Yeah, I guess you would call it stagflation light. We are at a much lower level of inflation overall. I mean, back then we were practically in double digits when things are just beginning to get bad. But we're seeing a situation where it's entirely possible where you have a combination of uncomfortably high inflation and accelerating inflation, and declining growth and rising unemployment. This is the first time that we have faced accelerating inflation in quite a long time, and I don't know that people are quite ready for the effects of really trying to put the brakes on.
Maybe impossible, maybe too late. We read Martin Feldstein, economist at Harvard, of course, been very active in national economic policy, saying maybe impossible now. Bernanke, there may be no way to get a soft landing out of this. What might that mean for Americans, for households, household budgets?
I'm sorry, that's going to be hard for me to answer clearly, but it depends on the household. I mean, if you have suddenly been put out of a job and you can't get another one, it's really bad for your budget. The effects are incredibly uneven. Martin Feldstein is pretty pessimistic about the chances for pulling off a soft landing, and in the camp of those who say that the inflation problem is much harder to lick than the Fed seems to be letting on. I should say that there is a growing school of thought that says the Fed is not really going to try to reduce inflation as much as it has implied, that this goal of getting the underlying rate of inflation down to 2% is something that they're willing to punt on for a while. I don't know. The alternative school is that the Fed is comfortable with a much steeper decline in growth than they've been letting on. Something's got to give.
Not happy times on either side of that fork. Edmund Andrews with the New York Times, thanks very much for bringing us in here.
My pleasure.
We're talking about the U.S. economy and new fears of recession, inflation, stagflation. Joining me now from New York is Lakshman Achuthan, Managing Director at the Economic Cycle Research Institute. He's a member of Time Magazine's Board of Economists and co-author of Beating the Business Cycle, How to Predict and Profit from Turning Points in the Economy. Lakshman Achuthan, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, hi, Tom. It's good to speak with you.
Also with me in the studio, On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you here.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
Lakshman Achuthan, what's your view? Are we headed for a soft landing or something rougher?
Well, that is the $64,000 question, and I don't know that it's knowable today, truth be told. To forecast where we are headed in the cycle, we focus on leading indicators of the economy, and those correctly anticipated the current slowing that you're seeing in measures like GDP or job creation. And they have yet to turn up, so we don't have any acceleration in front of us in growth. But they also have yet to deteriorate to the extent that they did in early 2001, which was the last time that they kind of fell apart ahead of the previous recession. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of on this track where I suspect there's a fork in the road ahead. And one angle is going to take us towards a soft landing. The other is going to take us towards a harder landing. And I wouldn't prejudge either outcome.
Do you think Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve Bank are serious about fighting inflation, or are they going to play footsie with inflation in order to hope for something softer here, and in that risk inflation roaring down on us?
Yeah. Well, certainly they are balancing two risks. One risk that they would like to avoid, I believe, is a hard landing or a recession. At the same time, they certainly do not want to risk inflation getting out of hand or being behind the curve and playing some very aggressive catch-up on inflation. Looking at the leading indicators, clearly we've got slowing in the economy ahead, although it is not definitively by any means recessionary. At the same time, looking at leading indicators of inflation, there is some evidence that they may have peaked out a few months back, but they clearly remain elevated. So what that means to us is we don't have inflation running out of control from here, but neither do we have a situation where we can say that we're out of the woods. We certainly still have elevated underlying inflationary pressures.
We're talking this hour about the U.S. economy, warnings going up about recession, inflation, stagflation. We're asking whether the Fed can thread the needle to keep the good times rolling. On Point News analyst Jack Beattie's with us from New York. We're joined by Lakshman Achuthan, Managing Director of the Economic Cycle Research Institute. And right now from Chicago, we're joined by Carl Tannenbaum, Chief Economist for LaSalle Bank Corporation, $100 billion banking group organization out of Chicago, an affiliate of the Dutch ABN AMRO Bank. Carl Tannenbaum, thanks very much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Talk about the economy, and it's easy for things to look scary. On the other hand, maybe they'll keep rolling well. What do you see ahead?
Well, I'm a little more sanguine, perhaps, than our other guests. The economy is growing at a slower pace, but still most economists assign a fairly low probability to a recession emerging. There still is quite a bit of economic activity going on. We have very low unemployment. Incomes have been growing. Those tend to be the best predictors of things like housing activity, and while we don't seem to see the speculation or the madness surrounding some markets, neither is it likely that we'll have a nationwide crash in home purchasing or prices. So all of that we have going for us. We have had a community of American companies who have had wonderful profits over the last number of years. They're using those to invest in new equipment, to take new space. Obviously, hiring has been much better over the last 12 months than it was during the first 12 months of the expansion. So while we certainly have issues ahead of us, I'm not sure that we're in imminent danger of falling off the map.
And at the same time, Lakshman Achuthan, as I look around, I see economists all over the place really wringing their hands. Now, maybe we'll dodge the bullet, but what are the factors that have economists in many quarters so concerned right now?
Well, you know, I think a lot of economists have kind of a whiplash. I mean, they were predicting recession or very nasty kind of economic activity in 2005, and we had all kinds of bad things happen, like storms and gas prices going up and so on and so forth, and the economy kind of sailed right through. So when we go into 2006, everybody upped their forecast, and lo and behold, GDP came in lower, and employment growth has started to sag. So I think that has a lot of economists starting to get more negative. On top of that, we do have some real softness and maybe even downturns in some of the home prices around the country, which is going to weigh on consumer spending, which has been kind of the bellwether. It's been a key piece of the engine driving the economy along. The hope is that businesses will step in and kind of pick up some of the slack. And while they've done that to some extent, they haven't been, you know, completely committed to doing that. So I think that's why we have a lot of concern about the economy going forward. And finally, and most importantly in our view, the leading indicators are weak. These leading indicators, which correctly anticipated the softness we're seeing in 2006, they haven't turned up yet, including leading indicators of home prices. So there's plenty that's pointing to continued moderation in growth, but I would agree with Carl that we've yet to conclude that means an outright recession.
But concerns in serious quarters that we could get there, could even get there with something even more difficult, stagflation.
Right.
Jack Beattie,
Alan Greenspan managed to tiptoe through the tulips for a long time. He rode the tech bubble. He rode the housing bubble, maybe created it with those low interest rates. Now Ben Bernanke's inherited a whole different ball of wax.
He sure has. And, you know, Alan Greenspan, I mean, the fight against inflation was one of the major achievements of the last 25 years under Republican and Democratic presidents, and especially under Mr. Greenspan. And but, you know, he also was Fed chairman at a time of declining energy prices. And that changes the calculus, since energy gets into everything. And it just when it's cheap, it makes the prices down. So when it's up, it boosts the costs of everything and puts a kind of incubus on the economy, a real weight. And, of course, in the 70s, we saw what that did. It produced this stagflation, and that was partly because of the quadrupling of oil prices in the Arab oil boycott. So we're in a different place, and the energy sector seems to me to be the big difference.
I want to begin to bring our listeners in here. They're living in this economy. Greg's calling from York, Pennsylvania. Hi, Greg. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My first question, I have two, is how is the war in Iraq and the Middle East and everything that's going on over there affecting the economy here? And the second question is, they were been talking about housing. I'm wondering how people are dealing with the raise in the median price of a house that's gone up between $75,000 and $100,000 in the past 10 years.
It's gone up over the decade, but down, we read, in 28 states in the last month. But we'll look at that. Carl Tannenbaum, first to you. I mean, in the quarters where there is fear of recession, they might well have, I don't know, at one time looked to Congress for a stimulus package, but maybe we spent our stimulus package in Iraq. I mean, hundreds of billions there. Does that factor into the big economic picture here?
Well, let me see if I can take the second question first and then wrap it back to the first.
Great.
The decline that we're seeing, not the decline, moderation we see in housing affects us two ways. First, it's clear that inventories are building and home builders, both high-end and low-end homes, are not going to be nearly as busy. And we see that expressed in the recent survey of confidence amongst home builders. So clearly, the demand for contractors and such, and perhaps some of the pressure will be taken off of the costs of construction, and that will be seen as relief on inflation. On the other hand, you know, just anecdotally, I mean, remodeling is still fairly active. And the other way that housing affects our economic picture is that houses and house wealth have been used to finance consumer spending. A recent study, though, from the Federal Reserve Bank of, I think it was Philadelphia, took a look at that wealth effect from housing and found it to be relatively modest. In other words, it didn't contribute that dramatically to spending on the way up and may not rob us of spending power on the way back down. The other thing that you find is that while it has been a big resource and people perhaps should be careful about it, there still is a tremendous level of untapped home equity in the United States. So this impression that there are a lot of borrowers that are teetering on the edge of bankruptcy or will have to really seriously adjust their consumption patterns because of the moderation in home price appreciation is probably an overstatement. However, I think it would be very difficult for the housing industry to extend a hand to the government. It's arguable that the housing industry receives about as favorable a tax treatment as any other industry in the United States already, so I'm not sure that they would be in line for it, especially after they had, you know, 4, 5, 6 years of wonderful progress. But as you mentioned, I think another limitation, and this maybe filters back to what the Fed needs to do, is that our hands are very much tied in terms of stimulating the economy with fiscal policy. Because of our deficits, not just today, but what worries me is what they're going to look like in 5, 10, 15 years. And so the Fed is really front and center, not just at trying to sustain the expansion, but trying, as you've said, to thread that needle. Getting to soft landings is not easy stuff. The economy does not stop on a dime, even though Greenspan made it seem so easy. I would say that his sense of timing very often was wonderful, and perhaps the sense of timing and departure was perfect as well, because he saw that the situation was probably going to develop where choosing a policy between inflation fighting and growth promotion was going to get harder, and he left that over to his successor.
And specifically about the billions spent in Iraq, is that enough, even at the hundreds of billions, to factor into the big economic picture here to cut us off from a bailout package, or is it a sideshow?
I think it's very limiting, and I hate to sound, this is going to be a strange-sounding statement, but believe it or not, war spending can be very stimulative to the economy. Just ask the shareholders of Halliburton and some of the other suppliers over there, even though I'm sure most citizens would prefer that we were not there. The other byproduct of the war, of course, is what it's doing to confidence and gas prices. Certainly the tension in the Middle East and as well with other oil-producing countries really casts a pall over the security of supply and its cost. And so I think America is gradually getting used to $3 per gallon gasoline, perhaps higher, and trying to move ahead in that light.
Carl Tannenbaum in Chicago, stand by. I want to turn to a neighbor of yours in Evanston, Illinois. Robert Gordon is with us. He's a professor of economics at Northwestern University, a leading expert on inflation, unemployment, and productivity growth, author of The Measurement of Durable Goods Prices and Productivity Growth, Inflation, and Unemployment. Professor Gordon, thanks very much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
You have been quoted saying, sir, that the economic slowdown that we're going to need to rein in inflation is going to be or has to be much more substantial than anybody in the Federal Reserve or Wall Street is expecting. What are you pointing to there?
I'm pointing to an old phenomenon that we went through in the 1970s, again in the 1980s, called stagflation. That is the simultaneous upsurge of inflation occurring at the same time that real economic growth is slowing down. There is nothing the Fed can do in such a situation, and the reasons why it faces the situation are, first of all, the higher oil prices that you've already been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Second, the previous and forecast decline in the U.S. dollar, which is going to make the imported goods that we buy from abroad more expensive. And third, something that I don't think you have talked about yet, and that is the role of productivity growth in helping to create the image that Greenspan was a magician in the late 1990s and early part of this decade.
That growth has been pretty good for a while now.
Well, it's you need to say more than that.
Please
do.
We
had 25 years of dismally slow productivity growth in the United States from 1970 to 1995.
Mm-hmm.
We got a two-phased revival. First of all, the IT revolution of the late 90s pushed productivity up from, say, 1.5% to 2.5% a year. And then, briefly, in 2001 through 2003, it went up another notch to above 3.5% a year. But
and
that
now?
Was temporary.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's sliding back down. And over the last year, it's been in the mid-2% area, back to where we were in the late 1990s. Now, the important thing about this is that when productivity growth goes up, labor costs go down because we count labor costs per unit of output,
right.
per amount of output that each hour produces.
Mm-hmm.
So Greenspan's magic was built on the back not only of higher of moderate energy prices in the late 90s, which you've already talked about, but also in this productivity upsurge. Everything is symmetric. As productivity growth now slows down, this is yet another cause of the increase in inflation that we're seeing.
I want to ask you something if I may. You said there's nothing the Fed can do. We are accustomed for many years now to the Fed pulling off what seemed like miracles.
The Fed doesn't control inflation. Everybody talks as if it does.
We thought they did by pushing interest rates up.
The Fed controls interest rates. Interest rates then affect spending.
Mm-hmm.
That affects production.
Mm-hmm.
And if production goes down enough and unemployment goes up enough, that's the process that leads to an adjustment of inflation, downward or in the opposite direction, upward. I think the Fed overstimulated the economy in the last 2 years. As a result, we're seeing inflation go substantially above the so-called 2% comfort zone of Bernanke and his fellow governors.
So when you say that the Fed is facing an absolutely classic case of stagflation, quoting you there again, and it's going to take a tougher slowdown than the Fed or Wall Street imagines, or it's going to be part and parcel of that, what does that slowdown look like? What's the prospect?
First of all, there's another option, and that is the Fed abandons its 2% inflation target and just stops talking about it and lets inflation sort of glide along as it is in the upper 2%, 3% range, because it realizes the cost of trying to beat inflation back down to where it was 2 years ago.
Well, what's the cost of each of those paths, then?
Well, okay, the cost of abandoning their target is they lose their credibility, and people say, okay, we no longer have a Fed committed to stopping inflation, they also then singled themselves out from their brethren at the Bank of England and the European Central Bank in saying, okay, the U.S. is soft on inflation compared to all of these wise central bankers in Europe. I think it would be embarrassing for them to go down that route, although I think they may in the end, as always happens in the Fed.
But embarrassing sounds the least of it. I mean, isn't that damaging?
Well, embarrassing to the Fed versus causing millions of Americans to lose their job. That's what they're facing as their trade-off.
I mean, if they take the other fork, if they tighten up in order to try and rein in that inflation.
That's right. And tightening up partly has already been done. But we have this anomalous situation that they have continued to tighten short-term rates, but the long-term bond rate continues to be relatively low by historical standards.
If they loosen up on inflation, does that mean the good times keep on rolling, the party goes on, or does that somehow come back to whack us?
I think we've already taken away the punch bowl through the effect of the interest rate hikes that have already occurred. Carl was just talking about the effect of mortgage refinance and sustaining consumer spending over the last 4 years. That's going away. We're going to see not only, he mentioned future unemployment of construction contractors and construction workers. What about all those mortgage brokers that have been living high on the hog with low interest rates for the last 4 years? Many of them are going to find that their business dries up. And so they're going to join the ranks of the unemployed. And it's going to trickle throughout the economy. But we're talking about millions of extra unemployed that would be needed to bring inflation back down from where it is now, core inflation 2.7 over the last year, down to around 2%.
Boy, these are rough choices. Let me take a call, if I may, Professor, from Boston.
Sure.
Dan's on the line. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi. I want to thank Professor Gordon for bringing up Ben Bernanke's credibility, because that seems like a pretty important thing right here. He mentioned that as one of the costs of changing the inflation target.
Yeah.
And I think the standard economic view on credibility of the Fed relates to the economy's expectations for inflation.
Sure.
And the more, if the expectations for inflation are perfectly in line with the Fed's view, then one theory has it, at least, that you can costlessly change inflation. But the problem is when prices fall, or firms think they have to lay people off because they don't know it's inflation if they're not expecting
it. So which do you see coming, Dan? Inflation? Unemployment?
Well, from where I'm standing, I just found a new job, so unemployment doesn't look so problematic. But I was hoping some of the experts there could maybe consider that cost and think about the implications for Bernanke's credibility.
Professor Gordon?
Let me take on this idea of expectations, that the Fed has some sort of magic dial that can affect expectations. That's not true. We live in a world of Missourians. Missouri is the show-me state, and people, when they look at forming their expectations of inflation, look at what is actually happening. They translate the actual facts of inflation into their expectations for the future. Any sound person has higher inflation expectations today than they did 6 or 12 months ago, because inflation is accelerating in front of our eyes.
We've been joined from New York by Lakshman Achuthan at the Economic Cycle Research Institute, by Carl Tannenbaum at the LaSalle Bank in Chicago, by Robert Gordon, professor of economics at Northwestern University, joining us from Evanston. Jack Beatty's with us as well. Charles is calling right now from Savannah, Georgia. Hi, Charles. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. You know, I guess I'm not that overly concerned about an tick up in the inflation rate of 1 or 2 points. My concern is rather the risk of hyperinflation. What amazes me is that nobody appears to look at the example of Argentina in the 20s and 30s. Back then, Argentina had the highest per capita standard of living of any nation in the Western Hemisphere. But out-of-control government spending resulted in massive deficits, which led to the hyperinflation that we all know about.
Do you really think the United States is in the same ballpark as Argentina in the 1920s?
I honestly believe it is, because if you look at what's happening with the federal deficit and the ever-increasing debt, and the fact that half of our government spending is kept off budget anyway, so you really don't see the true magnitude of the annual deficit, I think the boulder that we're pushing ahead of us in terms of national debt and what it means in terms of servicing that debt 10 years from now, the annual cost of servicing that debt, is going to be horrendous. It's going to eat all of the discretionary spending.
Could roll back down on us with a vengeance. Let me put that to our panel. Lakshman Achuthan, it's been so long since we had a real inflation problem here. Many Americans, I think, have stopped worrying about it, but Charles is worried and even worried about hyperinflation. Economists clearly take this, I think, more seriously than the general public at the moment. How do you look at it?
Well, again, we're approaching this from a cyclical view and looking at leading indicators of inflation. And while they're elevated, they're not running away, which I think I'm pretty confident they would be running away if hyperinflation was some sort of imminent issue. I think there are a host of structural differences between the economy today and Argentina in the 20s. And I'm not saying that everything is hunky-dory with the U.S. Budget or fiscal house, but relative to the options out there, it's still quite competitive. If you look at the attractiveness of, say, you know, some of the major currencies around the world, they all have issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so people, at the end of the day, still have to make a choice where they're going to put their assets. But when we're talking about, you know, the Fed and what options they have in front of them, well, we talked about different scenarios. There could be a hard landing. They're trying to thread the needle and get a soft landing. Maybe they'll abandon this target that they've suggested. I think there's one other option here that should be added to the discussion, which is, you know, not something that the Fed has control over, and that is where the global economy is headed. It's important to consider the impact of the global economy on the U.S. economy and on U.S. policy. It's true that the global economy has been growing together in a pervasive way, Europe and Japan, for the last few years. That's a change. Back during the Greenspan miracle, there were asynchronous recessions. In other words, inflationary pressures were being kind of released a bit by weakness around the globe. Today, we have global growth that is synchronous. I don't know that we should assume that global growth is going to continue going up in the future. It may be one of the scenarios that global growth begins to ease. I think there are some indications of that, which on the margin could take a little bit of the pressure off that we're talking about here with inflation today.
Robert Gordon, what about the hyperinflation fear we heard from Charles in Savannah there?
The biggest difference of all is that when Argentina runs big fiscal deficits, they have to print money to finance those deficits. We have a second option, which is the way the United States finances its deficits, and that is we have an enormous bond market with a huge appetite, particularly from foreign central banks, to buy American denominated U.S. government bonds.
Mm-hmm.
That's the big difference, so that we can have deficits that are much larger than they are now without pumping up the money supply or generating Fed-financed inflation.
And yet that spending is very, very large. Do you see an inflation scenario that could...
Let's put it into perspective with the size of the economy.
Mm-hmm.
What matters is the ratio of the government deficit to GDP, which is nowhere near as big as it was a decade ago in the early 1990s. And what matters about our outstanding public debt is also its relation to GDP, and it's been down substantially thanks to the surpluses run at the end of the 90s under the Clinton administration.
So maybe you're in Bernanke's camp then, or what you imagine that to be. Let the inflation go a little bit. Why not?
I've always been skeptical of the enormous importance that central banks put on inflation, but of course it's a tightrope. You can't let inflation run away from you. I would prefer a policy of gradualism that implicitly abandons the 2% inflation target for a while, let the effects of the higher oil prices percolate through the economy. You know, everybody, including the Fed, looks at so-called core inflation, which leaves out food and energy prices, but it does not leave out airline fares that are pushed up by oil prices. It does not leave out the price of plastics and other petroleum-intensive goods. So inevitably, these higher oil prices are one of the things that is causing core inflation to go up, and that's something the Fed has no control over other than to create unemployment to push the economy down.
So maybe we're getting real and hoping it's okay. Doug's calling from Fall River, Massachusetts. Hi, Doug. You're on the air.
Hello. I would like to reaffirm and ask the panel's opinion on raw materials and how, and I what I haven't seen is the Fed really taking into account the change in the way raw materials are going up in price. We've seen rubber double in price, steel double in price, energy double in price. And I don't think the Fed can really, with changing interest rates, affect that as greatly as they could in the past.
Why not this time? Because of new demand abroad?
I believe that that's the standard line as to why steel is going up. When you have half of the construction cranes operating in the world or operating in China right now.
Let us pick that up, Doug. Thanks for your call, Carl Tannenbaum. How about it? How does this huge demand in China, in India, beyond affect the U.S. economy here? Does it mean we're going to see higher and higher raw materials prices and therefore built-in inflation?
Well, I think the answer is certainly yes. The pressure on raw materials prices has been stunning in some markets, with doubling and trebling of prices for some metals and minerals, clearly reflecting an accelerated pace of growth globally. But let's step back for a minute and try and understand how that might affect the general rate of inflation. First, you have a translation through how productively we use them, and obviously firms are always looking for more efficient ways of using the raw materials that are there. We're also looking for substitutes, and while it takes time, when something gets real expensive, the accelerated pace of exploration and research into how that commodity is used eventually leads to some moderation. Secondly, while for some industries these are critically important, for many others they're not. And we really can't have a hyperinflation or a big rise in inflation in the United States, in my view, unless it's coming from wages, because we're two-thirds of the service economy and the biggest component of costs for most companies are our wage costs. And I would define those broadly as to include health care and benefits. There, the news has been relatively muted. Bob's warnings on productivity are certainly important, but looking at the recent past, the fact is that either productivity growth or the fact that a lot of production can be or has been shifted overseas have held wages down, either by serving as a threat against current workers or through the specific action of sourcing things from their cheapest possible source. So we have not seen that lip over. I want to follow up as well on the general picture. I think Bob made a great point. Bernanke came into office knowing that he had a tough act to follow. And one of his tenets was is that perhaps the reputation of a central bank in managing inflation or growth shouldn't be based so much on individual personality, but rather on a style and a policy. And this is where the idea of an inflation target began to gain currency, because whoever was the chairman, if the market was convinced that inflation would be held to a certain range, that they would then give the credit, inflation expectations would give credit to that regime. But clearly, implementing an inflation rule is a hard thing to do. What level do you pick?
Right.
What kind of discipline surrounds it? And do you have, especially in our country where we have a dual mandate, other central banks are solely focused on inflation, how do you mediate between those competing ends? I would suggest to you that the Fed right now has probably already abandoned its 2% ceiling that has been expressed in some testimony and in speeches, because we have inflation, core inflation, that is running clearly over 2% and is heading northwards. Inflation expectations, which the Fed has termed under control, are still calling for inflation in the 2.5% to 3% range. I'd say that if those we really had a 2% inflation target, the Fed would have been a lot tougher.
But does that mean we've got a credibility problem where there are no reins on the pony?
Yeah, but I'll tell you what I like to see, and I think this is what Bob is driving at, is that monetary policy is, as they say, a blunt instrument. There are a lot of variables to consider. I like to see room for discretion. I like to see room for interpretation and a realization that models are imperfect and that the evolution really requires a flexible approach that isn't so rigid.
Let me take a call from Los Angeles. Terry's on the line. Hi, Terry. You're on the air.
Hello, gentlemen. Yes, there's several problems that I see here. And I just see the Fed as basically a big Band-Aid, just frantically trying to put their finger, you know, in the holes of the dike. What you have, first of all, is the fraudulent ways of calculating unemployment and also inflation. I mean, you can't tell me we have 2%, 2.7% inflation. That's a joke. I mean, with raw materials, I mean, we deal with aluminum and things like that. It's gone up 20% so far this year. The other problem is in 1971, when Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard, you started having currency floats. At that point, production went down and speculation went up. And then we had all of our factories moving overseas trying to prop up their profits with cheap labor.
So what do you see coming, or where do you see us now, Terry?
Well, we're going into hyperinflational spiral. I mean, all the raw materials are going up. Look what's happening with fuel. I mean, it's insanity, and it's all speculation.
Who's it going to hit?
With the wars and stuff that are going on, these guys are just driving it off the roof. And the problem is you have to have it. It's not like shoes or something like that where, well, we're not going to buy right now.
our business depends on fuel costs, and we have to pay for it.
So who's up? Who's up and who's down in this game, Terry? Who's winning and losing here?
Well, the speculators are winning, okay, and the people sitting on the top with these huge salaries are winning. But all of us down here that are working for a living are getting killed. It's horrible.
Terry, we got it. Let me get one more call from Bridget in Sandusfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Bridget. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning, Tom. Actually, this is a good follow-up to the previous call because my point is that the little guy, I think, is not quite understood enough by the experts, and I'm one of the little guys. I have a college education. I have a good job. I built my own house with the low interest rates that I took advantage of 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I find myself not living extravagantly, not taking expensive vacations, and
yep.
I'm living very much on the edge. And like a lot of people I know, one more thing, one more expense is going to send us into an abyss. I'm not borrowing on my house. I'm not buying a lot of expensive things. I have a secondhand truck. I live in the country.
Do you feel the inflation already, Bridget, or not?
A lot. And the gas prices are hurting very much if you don't live in an urban area where you have the option of mass transportation.
Yep.
And you know, one more thing, one more $50 bill a month is going to send me into a very scary place, and I'm not alone.
Bridget, we've got it. And also from Terry in Los Angeles, Jack Beatty, here it is. We're talking about, okay, maybe we'll just accept a little more inflation, show some good flexibility, and maybe mega picture, that's right. But you've got individuals facing that and saying, wait a minute.
That means real family incomes go down. That's what inflation means. And that's intolerable for people. I mean, every month your paycheck doesn't you have a job, but you can't keep abreast of your expenses, of your past commitments. And
Would you rather tighten up and lose the job?
Well, there you are. There's the dilemma. But if you let a little of this inflation in, you get people saying things like our caller Bridget that where they just can't keep up with it, and especially when it's something so palpable and visible and every week as the energy cost. That is just something people, someone said earlier, we've accepted the $3 a gallon. Well, maybe we have, maybe we haven't, but it is a hard thing to accept.
If you've got some extra coin in your wallet, you can accept it. Robert Gordon, you've got a kind of Olympian view of the economy, but what do you say to Bridget there dealing with it day to day?
Another one of my recent papers has been on income inequality, and the Bridgets of the world are indeed suffering. Their wages are not keeping up with productivity, and much of the income growth is going to the top 5%, the top 1%, the top 1/100th of 1%. Bridget really underlined the reason I think the economy is already in trouble and is already in stagflation. We've talked a lot about the gradual creeping up of the inflation rate. We've not talked enough about the combined wallop to Bridget and other people of the higher gasoline prices combined with the end of the home equity refinance bubble. Many people have home equity loans that are tied to the prime interest rate, which goes up every time the Fed raises its interest rate. And you put those together, the interest rates and the gasoline prices, and the bottom two-thirds of the U.S. income distribution just cannot cope. And I think we're headed toward a recession no matter what the Fed does now. It's too late.
So what's the message then from Bernanke to Bridget, from the policy and situation we've got to the working person?
Bridget is just telling Bernanke he's in trouble and that there's no way out. He can't both have his inflation target and a steadily growing economy. We're in for a growth slowdown and probably next year a recession.
Jack, political consequences?
Well, in the 70s, two presidents had stagflation, both lost, Ford and Carter. And the I looked at the papers on this, on economics and the economy, and falls in real family income have predicted defeat in congressional elections for incumbent parties. Presidential elections are different. They can turn on other issues.
Lakshman Achuthan, do you see enough pain in the pipeline here that it's going to bleed out of your world and into the political world?
Oh, well, certainly. I think Bridget's, as Professor Gordon was saying, she's giving everybody the message loud and clear. I mean, we've got what Bridget's describing is all these things that you have to spend money on, food and energy. And if your budget is tight and these prices are going up, it doesn't matter what the statistics say. The reality is staring you in the face. I think that the Fed is certainly in a box here. The only possible way out, and I alluded to this before, is if we see slowing on the global economy, which I think will take some of the heat off of these energy prices and commodity prices. Mm.
Fed in a box and a lot of people with a big stake in how this works out. I want to thank all of the members of our panel this hour. Lakshman Achuthan in New York, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Carl Tannenbaum at LaSalle Bank in Chicago. Carl, thanks for joining us.
Our pleasure.
And Professor Robert Gordon at Northwestern University. Professor Gordon, thanks so much for being here.
Chicago rules.
Chicago rocks. Jack Beatty, always good to have you. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.